harping on wars we fight, griping about the great things all to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and falling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. The guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking. Down with life, I'm fighting and fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down with life, I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you run down my country, man, you're walking on the right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and, all, of course, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, today I'm going to play last week's Ethnostate program with Ken Givenan, Pastor Tom Robb, our chief host, the chairman of the American Freedom Party, Bill, and myself, Paul Fromm. Bill Johnson.
Hello, everyone. This is William Daniel Johnson, chairman of the American Freedom Party, here with another edition of The Ethnostate with Ken Givenan, Paul Fromm, and Tom Robb. Thank you guys for showing up. This last week, I had a really interesting gathering at my house. I had a professor from Japan, a very important university in Japan, contact me out of the blue and said, I'm professor of American Studies at Keio University, and I would like to come over and see what white nationalism was all about. So I go to Max, well, when you come to L.A., I'll take you out to lunch, and then you can come up to my house, and I'll invite a few people. And he says, oh, great. I'd like to meet some younger people from the Rise Above movement and things like that. So I sent the word out, and I said, well, we'd like to have some people come over. That can talk to this professor and just tell him what our views are on white nationalism. So I sent the word out to a few people, and we had about 40 people show up at our house. It was a really big, big, nice turnout. We had food for everybody, and I had some outdoor. We rode, got some horses, settler horses, and ride the horses. We shot guns, and we shot crossbows and bow and arrows, and Mr. The professor from Japan brought a whole bunch of goodies, and so those that were the best marksmen got all these goodies. It was really kind of fun. But then we sat around in our living room, and we all talked about, Mark Weber from the IHR gave a speech about 15 minutes. Then after that was over, we sat around and we talked about issues. This professor asked us pointed questions about what white nationalism was all about. And so we answered it. We told him what our fears and our hopes and our dreams were. And he wrote, after he went back to Japan, he wrote me and said he was very impressed with our meeting. And he says, seeing is believing, I'm very impressed. But then when he was there, this is what he brought up. He says, you know, in Japan, America is now becoming very much criticized and ridiculed because of all of the shootings that are taking place and all of the mass killings that are happening throughout the United States. And he mentioned this in our meeting on Saturday, and this was just a few days before all of this eruption took place in Dayton and El Paso with all these shootings. And I'm sure that he's appearing on a lot of TV shows in Japan. And I'm sure they're going to ask him a lot of these questions about what is fueling all of this violence. And of course, our media focuses and say, well, the violence is fueled by Donald Trump and white nationalism. But the first issue that I want us to talk about is what is going on with all of these mass shootings. When I was growing up, we didn't have this. What's happening?
Well, you're asking. Well, I mean, but it's not really funny. You know, when you take a nation and you strip them of any moral foundation, then people have no foundation to stand on. Then everything, all the rules are over or recreated. So, you know, I think we have a nation that has stripped of some moral foundation, and without a moral foundation, then everything goes.
Well, also, I think that it belies that statement, diversity is our strength. Diversity, I think, is causing all of this great tragedies that's taking place. If you listen to all of the pundits, all of the newspaper reporters, all of the politicians, they will all blame white nationalists. They'll blame Donald Trump. They'll blame everything, but the real root of the problem. We are not one nation under God. We are many nations without God and without a moral underpinning. And so it has really wreaked havoc on our society. And this one kid that shot up El Paso, his manifesto was printed in all of the newspapers, and it was printed out there for everyone to read. And it was quite an interesting read. Did you guys read that, Paul? Did you read it?
Yeah, I read it. Downloaded it from the internet within hours. Yes, I read it.
What was the gist of that manifesto?
Despair at dwindling economic opportunities for white males, an industrial, manufacturing establishment that's being sent abroad, the replacement of the European founding Southern people of Texas with Hispanics. That's what I gleaned from it. You know, it's hard to disagree with much of the analysis. I don't agree with the shooting people, but I think that's where Pastor Rob's absolutely right. There's no moral grounding. There's so much diversity that there's no common understanding. And of course, many of these killings have nothing to do with any white nationalist ideology. The shooter up in Ohio seemed to have been an anarchist, an Antifa, following black metal. That's not Negro, but I mean, you know, like real dark, heavy metal type of stuff. I don't think there's a consistent pattern.
But why is it that nobody in the establishment or in power will come out and say what truly needs to be said? We cannot overcome this problem until we have our own ethno state. Then, when we are made up of our own people, then we can police them. We can weed out these Dayton, Ohio kids that listen to all this terrible debauchery on the of music, and we can correct our own people. But when we are so stretched out and attenuated by all of these different views and peoples and beliefs and cultures, you can't marshal, you can't police, you can't organize into a good, solid social structure.
Well, actually, we don't have diversity in this country. They say we do, but we don't. But we have a replacement of our culture,
yes,
with non-white culture. We are not part of this diversity. The diversity includes all Mexicans and blacks and Asians and transgender and everything you can name. But a diversity in their mind does not include white people. Does not include our values. Does not include our heritage. Does not include our ancestors. Does not include our history or anything that we hold valuable to. They don't include us in their diversity. We are totally stripped out and removed from their diversity, and we are being replaced. And we know this happening. You know that. I know that. Many people know that. I think many people who are not even connecting with white nationalism feel it in their heart, and that's why Trump has gotten so much support. They feel this threat upon them, and they may not understand it. They may not be able to actually give a diagnostic test of it, but they still know that it is not safe in their neighborhoods, it's not safe going to the shopping mall, it's not like it used to be. Something is wrong. They feel breathing down their neck. They're not afraid, the globalists are not afraid of us poor or people like us. They're not afraid of us, they're not afraid of our organization, you know, the Knights Party, they're not afraid of the American Freedom Party, they're not afraid of all these other conservative citizens, leaders. They're not afraid of them. What they are afraid of is the potential we have to reach a vast number of people. It's that potential that they are concerned with.
What do you think about Biden on CNN earlier today saying that there's a terrible conflict here and white nationalism is winning? I didn't know. Take that for what it's worth. Perhaps he's senile, but I do think they feel a real anger out there. Things have gotten out of control.
What was that comment today? White nationalism is what?
Is winning.
Winning.
Yeah,
winning. I think so. I think we are on the cusp of an awakening, but when it will come, I don't know. I mean, I've been waiting for it for 50 years, but you know, we're closer to it now than we were 50 years ago. But I do believe over the next 15, 20 years, maybe we are going to see a real shift as all hinges around balkanization and creation of this ethno state, which is the name of this program. And Daniel, you ought to, for a moment, maybe explain what we have a program called Ethno State, but what does that really mean?
Well, we have to have our own country and countries, just like we had for centuries, just like we had for millennia. And people are saying all the time now in our movement and even in other movements, they say, well, Asia for Asians, Africa for Africans, white countries for everybody, and that's not fair. We have to have our own country again. And one thing that this manifesto pointed on, it says, he mentioned an inconvenient truth. And I'd heard that phrase before, but I don't know where it sprang from. But he was talking about the inconvenient truth. What is that?
That is Al Gore's phrase when he was talking about the environment and he was explaining the world's coming to an end. He called that his inconvenient truth. That's where that originated.
Right, but when I read the manifesto, the inconvenient truth referred to the great replacement, I thought. That's what I gathered from it. It was the demographic shift replacing whites with the non-whites. And so is he kind of co-opting that phrase when he wrote that manifesto?
Yeah, he's just taking it from Al Gore, and he may not even know that. He may have got it somewhere else, but it's been around for a while.
But one thing I is interesting to note, and it's a little bit heartening, is that you had a manifesto that took place in New Zealand, and if you spread that manifesto out, you could go to jail for many years for just disseminating that, and people were arrested for spreading that manifesto, and then the manifesto of the El Paso shooter went out everywhere in America, and everybody could read it.
Do you you mind, Bill, if I just read two or three sentences from it?
Please read it. Yeah, please read it. It's important.
His political reasons, and he says in short, by the way, this is on my website if anybody wants to read it at a later time. In short, America is rotting from the inside out. A peaceful means to stop this seem to be nearly impossible. The inconvenient truth is that our leaders, both Democrat and Republicans, have been failing us for decades. They are either complacent or involved in one of the biggest betrayals of the American public in our history. One more sentence, the takeover of the United States government by unchecked corporations. That's not a sentence, but that's what it is. So, but it goes on like that. That's the gist of his point.
Yeah.
Basically, so, he's losing it.
But what I'm wondering is why, you know, if, you know, you can't come out and justify the action that he did, but why can't you come out and really say the solution? The solution isn't more gun control. That's just putting a bandage on the issue and not solving the problem. The solution is we need to have our own ethno-state. And I don't know of anybody in a position of power that's coming out and saying that. But if someone did come out and say that, why would that person come under attack? Why would that person be afraid to come out and say that? Because I think it's gaining legitimacy, as the United Nations says, that people have the right of self-determination. White people should have the right of self-determination. And I think if the first public leader come out and says, this is the solution, we need a divorce. Divorce is not good, but we got to divorce from all of these non-whites and start all over again. If the first person in power came out and said that, because it's right and proper and the right thing to do, I eventually think people would clamor it, and leaders would express it, that sentiment, in great numbers, I think.
Well, let me ask you guys this question. Are there any white ethno states anywhere?
No, none.
What about the community in the South Africa? Does that qualify, or is it just too small of a... It's like
very small.
Okay.
I was speaking about ethno state, but they're talking about the politicians coming out and promoting that or embracing that. Reminds me of an article that came on Time magazine in March of 2010. And the article is a title to it, on headline, or the front page rather, called the white anxiety crisis. And this goes back 2010, so this is 9 years ago. And they talk about how America is going to, and now this is anti, of course, you have to understand, Time magazine. But they point out that while America will be a majority non-white country by the year 2042, perhaps even earlier, they say, majority of the minorities will be in the coastal states. They talk about whites fleeing into the heartland of America. But what they say there is, as white people begin to flee into the heartland of America, white people begin to think racially, and from that will arise demagogues who will appeal to their white identity. And I think this is what we're going to see. It would be nice if somebody come out and would say that now, like you say, but we know they wouldn't last long on the political scene. But we are, this is an organic move, a growth is growing. White people are becoming identify themselves racially more, not a lot yet, but still more. And I do think we're going to see in the future this white, by force maybe, but this awakening, this identity.
You say that politician that would come out in the advocacy of a white ethnic state would not survive. I'm not sure that you're wrong, but I'm not sure that you're right. I just wonder what would happen if somebody...
Well, Steve King, who never even claimed that, but still would be close to identifying that, representative of Iowa, we saw what happened to him the minute he stood to identify with with the plight of white people. So also, if you remember, in 2015, from 1942 until 2015, if you said America first, you were called a Nazi. And then in 2016, Donald Trump said America first. And everybody says, you're a Nazi. And Donald Trump says, I don't care. I like that. America first, America first, America first. And now everybody is saying America first. And not only that, Japan is saying Japan first. And in fact, Guadalajara is saying Guadalajara first. And make Guadalajara great again. So get away with it.
Well, Ken is right in that if at some point a politician does that, and if he does survive, that could break the dam, and then there might be a flood after that.
Yeah, could be.
There may be a David out there who will pick up stones and bring the giant down.
Yeah, but
you have no stake, you know, what you're saying, Bill, that being the solution. I think this can be argued in a way that's recognizable. You know, the current immoral order says that nobody's actually ever responsible for what they do. It's somehow it's outside forces. I think it can be argued that certainly the shooter in New Zealand, the fellow in El Paso, and perhaps the man up in Pennsylvania. I think it can be argued. Look, the diversity has created intolerable psychological pressures on people. Many young white people don't see any future. So it's society's fault if they behave like this, and we've got to reorganize things in such a way that those pressures will be taken off, and the ethno-state will be a good thing.
That is focusing on the problem. That's offering a viable solution. You know, I mean, Governor Huckabee said, the only solution is we got to pray, you know? And I think, well, I'm not denigrating prayer. That's good, you know. But thoughts and prayers aren't going to do it. And
well, then David, the young shepherd boy, didn't say, okay, we got this Goliath problem. Let's all have a prayer meeting. You know, he picked up some stones and he went to battle.
Yeah, well, that's bad theology, because faith without works is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, my two little daughters had rooms right next to each other, and it was in the backyard of our house. And we had a little puppy that we didn't want to keep inside, so we kept him in a cage in the outside. And in the middle of the night, the little puppy's going, something was clearly wrong. And so my fourth child, the little girl, she got on her knees and prayed that everything would be okay. My fifth child, she got up and went in to wake Dad up and said, hey, something's going on outside. So I went outside in the middle of the night, had a flashlight, turned it on, and there was a huge old mountain lion as big as an African cat dragging this cage up the mountainside. And the little puppy inside was going, yep, 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 yep. And so that showed to me, you know, Clara, I got on her knees and prayed, but Laurel came in and woke me up and said, save the puppy. So, yeah, I agree with you guys. You got to take action.
Are you a puppy?
But, yeah, I saved the puppy. And and saved the mountain lion, too. He's been around. We have mountain lions up there, and they're majestic beasts. Except you can't call the police on them because the police just love to come out and shoot things.
Yeah.
So if you report them, they'll come out and kill them. But the mountain lions have always been gentlemen. When they've gotten into my ducks...
No, you're puppy that.
Yeah. When they've gotten into my duck cage, they've only killed enough ducks to eat. They're at the middle of the night, the ducks kind of get used to them, and they just kind of sit there and I have to chase them out. But the desert bobcats are not much bigger than a house cat. When they get into the chickens, they will kill everything, and they're not gentlemen. In fact, I had this shoot one out with a broom because I didn't want him to scratch me, and there was one chicken left, and just before he left, he reached over and slit his throat and then left. So, mountain lions are gentlemen, bobcats are Antifa.
So, what you're saying is, if we ever visit your house, we need to bring a firearm.
Well, I just bought a crossbow because I got to take out some of the deer. The deer, I just got so many deer, they're just killing everything. All of the trees, I have 400 persimmon trees, I'm just killing them all. But anyway,
let me mention a comment about firearms real quick. I had kind of funny interest. Incident happened today. My wife and I was up in Mountain Home, about an hour drive from here. We went to KFC to have dinner, and sitting at her table, just kind of behind her, she could see them, were six elderly ladies in the late 70s, at least, maybe the early 80s. Very old, much older than I am, okay? And then a guy walked in where I could not see, and he had a sidearm on him, okay? My wife mentioned, oh, that guy's carrying a sidearm, you know? I thought that was interesting. Or one of these old ladies saw it, you know? And she made some comment, which I did not hear, but then a discussion about guns came up. And it was very positive. The one woman said, yeah, we carry guns all the time. The other lady, probably about 82, 83, says, I go, oh, just, I didn't hear the whole thing, but she said, yeah, I told him, yeah, I carry a gun. You want to see it? So here we have six old ladies who are packing, I'm assuming, and I wouldn't want to mess with them. So that's what they're concerned with. Everybody carrying weapons of protection, you know, are not 17, 18, 20, 22, 23-year-old young buff guys. There are little old ladies out here who are packing and prepared to defend themselves, and they know that in this country there are a lot of people that have guns.
I know, but then the flip side of that is you have that story of where that cop who's trained to shoot guns, he was trying to help out a lady, and the lady's dog charged him, or he felt he was charged, so he pulled out a gun, bam, 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 missed the dog and killed the lady. They're going to have a lot of, what is it called, collateral damage, and everybody's back in heat. But, you know,
he wasn't an affirmative action fire.
It probably was, but in any event.
Was he a black cop? Maybe he really wasn't there to protect her.
No, I think he was a white cop and a black dog.
anyway.
I don't know. But in any event, another point I wanted to make is that we were in this meeting with this Japanese professor, and they were talking about all this immigration and all this changing demographics, and he said kind of smugly, well, you know, Japan took some refugees in. Last year, we took 42 of them. And so, but you know the reaction to a man from everybody in that room was, that's too many. That's 42 too many. So, there's some hope out there for some of the for some countries, but not ours.
Well, I think it's safe to say that nobody here or no, most white people don't want trouble. We don't want violence. We don't want have to defend our homes with guns and violence. We would rather just have a safe community. And so for the media tried to imply that we're all gun prone, waiting for an opportunity to shoot somebody is really, really, you know, wrong. But that's the narrative they want to create. But as far as I know, people I know just want a safe community, safe schools, safe homes, safe neighborhoods.
Yeah, before you go on, Paul Kersey had a story on his website. Between July 16th and July 28th, 2019, there were 36 mass shootings. Blacks were suspects in 34 of the 36.
Yeah.
But we don't hear about any of those.
That shows the imbalance of our judicial system, our justice system. Criminal system that they're picking, that they're going after only the black people. They should be going after the white people too, because we don't you know that?
Well, actually,
they're just targeting the blacks for investigation. What's the matter with you, Ken?
My great grandfather, who I was named after, William Didymus Johnson, he was in Arizona in the Wild West, and he was head of the Mormon Church out there, along with the Tonopah Lynn. In church, one time, somebody got up and started talking in church that he didn't like. So he got out and he pulled his pistol and said, okay, you sit down or I'm going to shoot you. So we don't see that in our church services today. So we have made some progress. We don't have pastors gunning down the congregants.
You know, one figure that's gotten very little notice with the last shootings in El Paso and in Ohio is the death toll in Chicago this weekend. I think I saw on the internet 20 people were killed, and dollars will get you donuts. Every one of them was a Negro, and probably all the first were.
Yeah.
However, I heard of 55 people killed in Chicago since the beginning of the year. No, that's not correct.
Wow.
You said the statistics.
The
55 shootings.
I think it was 244 that I read through.
Okay. But still, this goes to support the statement that the Japanese professor made, saying that the Japanese people think America's crazy with all this gun violence. So no matter who's doing it, you know, they're thinking, if I'm going to come to America to visit, I'm going to have to learn how to duck. Because there's just bullets flying everywhere.
Well, let me ask you the unspeakable question. Do we have a gun violence problem, or do we have an ego problem? That will get me kicked off YouTube.
Well, Ann Coulter, that's what she said a few years ago. We don't have a gun problem, we have a demographic problem.
Well, that's a good way to say it.
That's a more polite way to say it, but it's a black problem.
Well, we don't have anything quite like you. But this past weekend, we had something called Caravana, which pretty much explains itself. A lot of West Indian bands and parades. And this year, really intrigued to know that the women were allowed to dance topless down the streets. And every year in Caravana, there's shootings. And the press is very coy about the way it reports it. But this toll this past weekend was something like 20 people shot in various incidents. And even in the most supposedly right-wing paper, the tabloid, the Toronto Sun, there's no direct mention of who the victims are or who the suspects are that they're looking for. But if you read between the lines, if you read the locations where these shootings occurred, you know, it's public housing in a black area. And there was a nightclub where there was a mass shooting, and the police are looking for two gunmen. But they don't tell us what the color was, but the area, it was a black after-hours nightclub. But the media, at least up here, is really complicit in suppressing important information. And I noticed that the media is in terms of the Ohio shooter, is still saying he followed an ideology of violence. And you can get mine on the internet that he was an anarchist. He hated Donald Trump. He abused women, and he told school chums. He had even a shooting list, a list of a hit list of people he wanted to murder. But they don't identify the culture of violence. He's a radical anarchist. Whereas with the shooter in El Paso, this is white nationalist or white supremacist.
Well, in any event, let's move on to the next topic because I think this analysis of an analogous of what happened in South Africa is happening in America now. You had the whites were in control of the country, and then slowly, incrementally, everybody turned against the whites. The world turned against the whites there, and the whites ceded power to the blacks, and now you have the terrible situation. Well, the same thing is beginning now in America. You have incremental changes that are taking place, and this first article that I want to talk about is the removal of Jefferson Davis from the park. So, King, can you tell us what's all that about?
There is a park in Virginia. And let me just read the story. Fort Monroe, this is from the governor of Virginia, Ralph Northam. Fort Monroe is where the first enslaved Africans arrived on our shores in 1619. He says a memorial glorifying the president of the Confederacy has no place there. So there was like a archway that spanned the entryway of the park. And it had Jefferson Davis's name on it, I guess Jefferson Davis Park or whatever. And so they took down his name because that is glorifying, what is it glorifying?
Confederacy.
What's wrong with that?
Pardon me? But see, the Confederacy, we have had conflicted views regarding race since the very founding of this country. I mean, the very first cabinet that had a non-white a non-Christian, someone other than the WASP or Anglo-Saxon heritage in its cabinet was the Confederacy. Jefferson Davis had Judah Benjamin in there as the Secretary of, had to be Secretary of Treasury because he couldn't drop anything with money. I'm not sure what he was.
But he was Secretary of State.
Okay.
But in any event, one was the Treasury of the South.
Even though the Confederacy is supposedly the big bad pro-white faction of America, they're the first ones that had him in there, and he was more treacherous and treasonous than anybody ever in the history of cabinet, sitting in the cabinet. I mean, he probably is the one that had Lincoln killed. You had John Wilkes Booth running around meeting with Judah Benjamin's buddies, and so then after the death of Lincoln, he burned all of his papers, ran off to England, and then became a legal pundit and wrote some books there. And he had a cushy life his whole life, but he was the first. You know, he was the first Jew in a cabinet, and he was for the Confederacy. And in fact, I remember reading, and it really bothered me to this day, saying, he was talking to a Christian, he says, well, when your ancestors were herding pigs in Europe, my ancestors were talking to God, you know, where we're communicating with God. We are the prophets, and you are the pig herder. And, you know, I think, yeah.
It was the city that elected the first Jewish senator, too.
Yeah, okay. So in any event, but the point I wanted to make when I first prefaced this issue is to say that they were following what South Africa, in the same path that they followed down. However, I believe that the situation is not so bad now because it's starting earlier with us when we still have more power to wake up and change. In South Africa, they started when the whites were such a vast minority that they couldn't do anything about it. If we wake up, if through incremental things like this, we begin to lose our identity and we wake up, we can reclaim ourselves before it's too late. So I'm kind of glad that it's coming fast and fast for all of this anti-white rhetoric that's coming everywhere you go, this erasing of our history. It needs to come now as opposed to in 20 years because it'll help us wake up sooner.
If you stop to consider the horrific conditions that blacks lived in Africa before they were purchased and brought to the United States, or what became the United States, they should be celebrating because these people, I mean, it was like winning the lottery. People get mad at me when I say that, but to be sold into slavery and brought to North America, that was a life-saving event. Because the chieftains who owned black slaves in Africa would slaughter them. I mean, it was a death sentence to be a slave in Africa. We literally saved their lives. And blacks living in the antebellum South had a better standard of living, higher standard of living than any blacks anywhere on the planet at that time. So, well, we should be, by the way, let me just say this very quickly, I don't consider them slaves. I consider them adoptees. They're like members of the family. They were they were protected by laws. Very different from what's portrayed.
To support what you just said, we have a very wealthy black man in the American Freedom Party. He makes a lot of contributions and he's well connected because a conservative black man can go a lot of places that a white nationalist can't go. In fact, he just had my resume sent to the White House to see if we can get a nationalist in the White House, which is not going to happen, but at least he's trying. But he says, you know, my father was, and I asked him, I said, why are you think like you did? Why are you so supportive of white people? He says, well, my father was a driver for all of these singers that would go through the South. He would drive all the trucks for Harry Como or Pat Boone or Aretha Franklin or whatever it was, you know. And he said to me when I was growing up, he says, don't you hate the white man. Everything you own is because of the white man. You are successful because of the white man. If the white man was not here, if the white man did not do this, we would not have any success whatsoever. So he says, you know, that sunk in to me, and I agree with that. And so that's why I'm a big supporter. So that goes along to support what you were just saying.
Well, consider trying to get this guy on the show. I know you're a little reluctant to do that, but man, I'd love to talk to him.
Okay, I'm not so reluctant as I am lazy. I'll talk to him and see if I can get him on the show.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but lazy is my department.
Okay, however, we cannot leave this story without me bringing up the fact that the largest independent cotton grower in the state of Arizona was my grandfather, and his dad was named Jefferson Davis Simmons. So I got some Jefferson Davis heritage in my family. Well, not direct line, but so much so that they named a little baby after him, and that grew up to be my great-grandfather. So I gotta say that. Okay, so in any event, let's move on to another topic. The next one is, that I want to talk about is, out-of-staters rush to Baltimore to clean up mess. So that's a whole other area of problems that we have there. So Ken, tell us about that story.
What is interesting about the story is the guy who organized the cleanup is a avid Trump supporter. So everyone knows the story between Congressman Elijah Cummings and Donald Trump. Cummings accused Trump of being a racist, and Trump responded by voting for poverty and the rats that were in his district, which is Baltimore. And the guy wound up with egg on his face, maybe literally, I don't know, but the story is that this guy, I'm trying to find his name here, according to Washington Examiner, it says that volunteers from several states banded together to clean up Baltimore streets following a tweet last week from President Trump asserting that Baltimore is a, quote, disgusting, rat and rodent-infested mess. So this guy organized, his name is Scott Presley, so he organized the cleanup. Now, how much of a dent are they going to make in Baltimore? Probably not much. Whatever they clean up, how long is it going to stay clean? Probably not very long. But the point is, these are white people coming in, Trump supporters, well, not all of them, some of them are black in the photographs, but they're coming to clean up a mess. One more thing before I stop. I'm always mindful, when I think of black neighborhoods, these decrepit, run-down neighborhoods, at one time they were brand new. They were built by white people. There were beautiful homes with manicured lawns. Something happened, and they became decrepit after black folks moved in. And now we have to go in and take, and by the way, they said some of the garbage they found has been for 20 years. Been sitting here for 20 years.
Wow. However, one thing, there are a lot of things that our president does that really warms our hearts. And one of them, when he was getting all this attack saying, you're racist for calling Baltimore rat-infested, and all the criticism we got, his response was, he says, well, you know, Congressman Cummings, if you resign from Congress, I'll personally pay to clean up the rats. And so he doesn't back that. He just digs it in even further. Yeah. And so that was kind of clever for him.
The question I have is, why couldn't the blacks in their neighborhood, you know, their own neighborhood, why did they have to once again ask whitey to come clean it up for them? Would they do it themselves?
Well, it seems to me there's a regression to the norm. I mean, that's what Africa looks like. That's what Haiti looks like.
Right.
In any black neighborhood anywhere, that's what it looks like. Now, we all know right. Black people who don't behave that way. But,
correct.
In the aggregate, that's probably, I'm not sure they can help themselves.
Well, it appears like they can't take care of themselves. They need the man to feed them, clothe them, health care, age-dependent children, everything. They need the existence of white people. Like Daniel mentioned a few moments ago, that black person, how about everything you have is because of the white man. And they seem to depend on their very existence from white people.
But and you will acknowledge that.
Yes, there will be some Manning Day, or was it Rock? Reverend Manning or something on TV?
Oh, yeah.
David Manning. Yeah, he seems to talk that way. And I actually met a fellow by the name of Daryl Davis, who's kind of a second-rated entertainer. A pretty good, actually, piano player, black fella. He is an entertainer. He's a civil rights activist. Daryl Davis. I met him a few years ago, and I recorded a conversation. He actually mentioned, he said, whatever, and he's black. He said, whatever black people move to a neighborhood, he said, they destroy it. And it's absolutely true.
Well, what's interesting, though, in here is what didn't happen. A group of Trump supporters who are white get gathered together and try to do some cleanup in Baltimore. Where are the wealthy, prominent blacks who've done very well in the white system? Why would they not put something together? You know, like Oprah Winfrey or Tiger Woods or some of the rap stars. Why wouldn't they do something for their community? I think it's really significant that once again,
I wonder if after they did a cleanup, if a group of blacks got together and made a public, a public statement thanking them for coming. Black community thank these people for coming down and cleaning up? Maybe they did. I don't know. Because like you say, every black person doesn't act that way. I've met decent black people that were kind of considered caring and want to keep the neighborhood clean. There are people like that. But when you look at people as a corporate race, it seems like they're unable to do it.
I wonder if Rosie O'Donnell and Michael Moore would organize a cleanup.
Yeah, I don't know. However, what Pastor Rob says is true. You have a community called Watts in Los Angeles, and you had the Watts riots. That's very famous for all of the violence and the riots. It's a black area of town, and it was famous for being Watts riots. Well, maybe 10 years ago, I had to go to Watts, and I went down there, and they were all nicely manicured lawns. It was really a nice little suburb, a black suburb, and you had all these Mexicans keeping up the lawn. So these wealthy blacks were hiring Mexicans to keep up their lawn, but it was a nice, beautiful suburb. Totally different than what I expected. So there are areas where blacks can, again, keep it clean. But the point that I want to make regarding Baltimore is I remember maybe 20 years ago when I first heard the phrase, and this was from I think probably Time Magazine, says, we have now entered into a post-Christian era. And that outraged me. Why are you saying that? You know, this is a Christian era, but it's kind of true. Over the ensuing years, truly, much of the world and much of America, much of Europe in particular, has moved away from Christianity, and it can truly be a post-Christian era. And so now I heard for the first time regarding this Baltimore instance, and they said, well, in post-Western Baltimore. And I thought, that's right. Baltimore, the country, the city where, what was that Poe, you know, Edgar Allan Poe was lived and all those wonderful things that took place.
Henry there, the Star Spangled Banner.
Yeah. And now truly, Baltimore is post-Western, is a post-Western city. And I when I first heard that, I analyzed and I compared my feelings when I heard post-Christian era to post-Western Baltimore. And it didn't shock me. It did not rage me. I was resigned to it. And I thought,
post-Christian and post-modern don't mean much freer and better. They mean terrible. This story is over 20 years old. My two boys were quite young at the time, and we went to Baltimore and wanted to visit the home of H.L. Mencken, the great American writer, and it had been in a German area of Baltimore. Baltimore was once, quite a German, quite a European town. But we got to the home, walked there, probably not very wisely, early in the morning. After seeing it, I asked the woman on the desk, the curator, could you call us a cab, because our hotel's about a mile away, the children were quite young, one was in the stroller. And she just said, well, cabs don't come here. I thought, maybe I didn't understand her. And I asked, okay, well, ma'am, could you call us a cab? We've got these two young children. She said, well, cabs don't come to this neighborhood. I said, why? And she didn't, well, she could tell I'm from out of state. So she said, it's, well, you know, it's a difficult neighborhood. it would have been horrible at night, but eventually got back to the hotel, and we went to a So we went to a restaurant that had an outdoor area with an awning, and it was quite hot. And it overlooked the square where there was a fountain statue to Lord Baltimore. And right in the middle of lunch, we saw this Negro pull down his pants and urinate into the fountain. Well, it was quite something explaining to a three-year-old and a five-year-old what was going on. You know, well, yeah. Good people don't do that, I think, is what we came up with. And I thought, but this is a symbol of the utter degradation of the city. I mean, it wasn't just one guy. It's the fact that there are parts of town where you can't get a cab. This is not kind or gentler.
Well, my first ancestor to come to the United States came in 1635 on the ship Marmaduke. His name is Captain John Johnson, and he went into Boston, and he was buried in a town called Roxbury, which is a suburb of Boston. And so when I was at Harvard Law School, I thought, well, I want to go see the gravestone of my great ancestor. So I tried to catch a cab. And I said, I want to go to Roxbury. And the guy said, no, I'm not taking you to Roxbury. And I had a difficult time getting to Roxbury. When I got there, I found the what's it called? The graveyard, and you couldn't get in. It was all fenced in, keep people out. There was graffiti all over the place, so you couldn't. I'm sure you could probably make a special appointment if you had armed guards to get in there. But that's happened. You know, that was certainly post-Western Roxbury. So that's happened to a lot of our cities. I mean, Harlem. Harlem is an area of Holland, and if you go to Harlem now, of course, it's all black. In fact, when I was at Columbia, there was a on Sunday, Lionel Hampton was playing at a Harlem church, and Columbia is not very far from Harlem, so I thought, well, I'll walk there, and because Lionel Hampton is a very good jazz player. He plays the vibraphone, very famous, so I started walking down there to go to, so that's in the middle of the day, and you got walking in the middle of the streets, and they closed the streets off because it was Easter Sunday, and you had all of these fat black ladies with hats on and white dresses. It was really Easter Sunday for them. They were dressed in the night. There were hats all over the place. It was really kind of fun. And I was walking up there, you know. It was in Harlem, but, you know, I figured it'd be okay. But they looked at me. What are you doing here, Whitey? What are you doing here, boy? Get out of here, you know. Everything was white versus black to them. And I was just wanting to hear it. So I went over there, and I was able to sit in the very back and watch him. But it was race everywhere you turn. Other people look at us as a racially and whites don't. And as a result, Western civilization is dying out. That's my comment.
Oh, that story, of course, is universal. My wife and I, and Rachel and Jason and their wives, we went to Ireland a couple years ago, and we stayed at a place in Dublin. And we were asked, the very first night, we kind of asked the fellow different things in the area. And he said, yeah, he said, go down. So he where to go to, and so on. He said, you enjoy down there. Then I can't remember the street now, but he said, when you're going north, don't go any further than the name of the street. Don't go any further than that street. He said, it's not safe. It used to be a safe area. It used to be really nice. It used to be safe, but over the past 10, 15 years, it's gotten bad. It's not safe anymore. But he didn't say why. So the next day, my wife, you know, middle of the afternoon, we thought, well, it's safe. Let's walk that way and see why. We saw why very quickly, because it went from white to non-white very quickly, a lot of arrows and so forth. I can see why it was not a safe place. So that's a universal problem throughout the world.
Well, we
can tell the same story. Cincinnati, Detroit, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Memphis, and Kansas City, and St. Louis, every city can tell the same story.
Can I ask you guys a question real quick?
Sure.
I live in a majority white neighborhood, have good friends who are Korean, but there's some black folks living in our neighborhood as well. But last week or so, I've noticed there's this big black guy, and he drives through the neighborhood in an Escalade. Never seen that before. And he's playing this loud rap music as he's driving, usually even with his windows up in the real bass. But I see him all the time, up and down the street. Even as out walking at 2 in the morning, that's all this. What's he doing?
I don't know, but I can tell you this. In his car or out of his car in a white neighborhood, he could get up at any time of the day or any time of the night and walk around totally safe. And if you look at our grocery stores that are predominantly white areas, that you have blacks or Hispanics or whatever come in, and it's totally fine. They'll come in and shop, they feel comfortable, they feel safe, they feel welcomed in a white community. It's as if there is a constitutional right to these people to live around white people. They feel comfortable and they enjoy it. But if we were to go around in these black neighborhoods at nighttime or even in daytime, it's spooky. We would be worried, and that's the issue.
Well, for good reason. But I'm wondering, and I've been in those neighborhoods, you know, a long time, but is it possible this guy is casing out the neighborhood, trying to look for places to break into?
Could be, or he might be looking for places to get philanthropy to. Maybe he's driving an Escalade, maybe he's wealthy, he wants to make a donation and to help out some middle-class whites so that they can send their kids to a better school.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because next time I see him, I'm going to flag him down and ask him.
Yeah, give him my address.
Okay.
And I have 20 bucks.
Yeah. All right. Well, actually,
speaking about that, there's a friend I have, I don't know if you want me to give his name, but I'm sure Paul probably knows him, and he's from Detroit area, and he carries with him some of those Zimbabwe $50 million paper notes and stuff like that, paper bills that aren't worth anything. And he says sometimes he'll drive, when he's down to Detroit, pull to a panhandler and pull up and say, motion, come over. He said, I'm the man. He said, what? He said, I'm the man. He's not about to change your life. He said, he'll handle one of these $50 million Zimbabwe currency notes. And he said, sometimes they get really excited. They think they're wealthy someday.
Yeah, I used to win those as chips.
They're excited.
Well, one of the most embarrassing and shameful things that I ever did in my life is that one time in church they're saying, we need to go out and help all these homeless people. You need to give money to the homeless people when you see them. Next time a homeless person comes up to you, give them some money. And that right upset me because I didn't have to know the term then, but that was really pathological altruism. It was really working against us. I didn't want to help the homeless people. And I was so bugged that when a homeless came up to me, I said, hey, I want to buy a newspaper. Can you give me a quarter? And so this homeless guy gave me a quarter, and then I left. And I felt so guilty. I went right around the block to find him. I couldn't find him anymore. But I felt guilty for the rest of the week taking money from a homeless guy. So that's just the way we are. That's just in our nature. We can't get beyond that.
Well, should we give up our, can we if we could, but should we if we could?
Well, no, but we gotta have our ethnostate first, and then we have to have the deserving poor, just like Bernard Shaw said in Pygmalion. You know, you have your undeserving poor like Liza Doolittle's father. We gotta help the deserving poor, but not the undeserving poor. And that, you know, we want to have that philanthropy in there.
Why can't we be nice to Africans in Africa? Why do we have to?
Well, we can if we do it with a long-term range. Say, okay, what's good for Africa, what's good for the people, what's good for the animals, the flora and the fauna is sterilization. Here's a Zimbabwe $500,000 note, get sterilized. And if we tied our contributions to them based upon mandatory birth control, that's good for this generation, it's good for the next generation, and it's good for the flora and the fauna. So that's what we need to do. So, you know.
And the mountain lions.
Yeah, the mountain lions. And then, actually, with the one last story I want to say,
Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. Back with you again tomorrow. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.